Welcome to another episode of our NCLEX review series. In this podcast, we continue to bring you valuable materials to help you prepare for your exam. Enjoy.
But there's good news. Cancer can be classified by the tissue or blood cells where the cancer originates and the type of cancer. So if you know the tissue of origin and understand the type, you already know a whole lot. Okay. So what are the two types of cancer? Well, they are solid tumors and hematologic malignancies. Solid tumors and hematologic malignancies. Now, let's take a minute and look at solid tumors first. Y'all, solid tumors arise from specific tissue, and we're going to cover two types of solid tumors. The first type of solid tumors we have are sarcomas. They begin in the connective tissues. So if they begin in the connective tissues, where will you see these tumors? Yes, in the bones, muscles, tendons, cartilage, nerves, fat, all those tissues that the body uses to connect or support other tissue. You see, that is how they get their name, connective tissues. They connect or support other tissues. Now, the second solid tumor is one you hear all the time, carcinomas. Now, carcinomas originate from the epithelial tissues, And y'all know that's the tissue that lines your organs, right? Right. So these are the cancers that originate from the lining of organs, like the lungs, the liver, the breast, colon, or prostate. Now, quickly, what is your biggest organ? What is it? Did you say skin? Probably not, because we don't think of skin as an organ, but it is actually the biggest organ, right? Yes. Look, have you ever heard of carcinomas of the skin? Well, sure you have. Remember basal cell carcinomas and squamous cell carcinomas? Look, so put a big old star by carcinomas, because it is the most common type of cancer. Now, the second category of cancer is the hematologic malignancies. Look, just from the name, where do you think these cancers originate from? Did I hear blood cells? Yes, the blood cells. Y'all, would that include the lymphatic system too? Yes, it would, because it is also part of the hematologic system. Hematologic malignancies originate from the blood or the lymphatic cells. So this would be all of your leukemias, your lymphomas, and your myelomas. Now, y'all, do we just wake up one day and have cancer? No, thank goodness for that. It takes time for cancer to develop, because cancer starts with just one abnormal cell that starts growing and dividing out of control. In other words, abnormal cells running wild. Now, I bet when you study cancer in school, your teacher used the word metastasis. I want you to ask your friend what metastasis means. Go. Did they say ability to travel? Sure they did, okay? In simple terms, that is what you need to know. The tumor or cancer cells have the ability to travel or metastasize to other places in the body. Metastasis is just traveling or extension of the primary cancer to other sites of the body. Now, how do you think this occurs? Well, it can happen by, number one, direct invasion. Number two, through the blood system, or number three, through the lymphatic system. So direct invasion, the blood system, or the lymphatic system. Now, did you know that half of all cancers have metastasized by the time they are diagnosed? Look, that's a scary number. So now, do you see why prevention and early detection are so important? Yes, you never want to catch a cancer after it's metastasized, do you? No. You catch it early, or even better, prevent it from happening in the first place. So let's talk about prevention for a few minutes. Y'all, cancer prevention is about modifying the risk factors. Now, there are things we can control in our lifestyle that will prevent the development of cancer. And if we know warning signs, well, we can catch it early. That's a good thing. So if you are a good nurse, you are going to teach your patients how to modify their lifestyle to decrease their risk. People need to know what signs and symptoms they should be concerned about. So do we all agree that a good nurse, that as a good nurse, we are going to provide our clients with patient teaching on lifestyle modifications to decrease their cancer risk factors? Yes, sure we do. Okay, so let's look at what some of the risk factors for cancer are. Now listen carefully, because these are things that the NCLEX lady will ask you in the health promotion and maintenance category. Now the first two risk factors we're going to talk about are connected. So look at our list. Tell me, which one is the number one cause of preventable cancer? I heard you say it, tobacco. Tobacco is the number one cause of preventable cancer. Now, I think we already knew that, but what combined with tobacco makes it even worse? That's right, alcohol. Alcohol plus tobacco are co-carcinogenic. Now, y'all, if you have alcohol and smoking in the presence of each other, that just makes everything a lot worse. Together, they make cancer develop a lot more quickly. So that's why we say they are co-carcinogenic. Now, what about diet as a risk factor? Yes, okay. Let's look at the risk factors that have to do with diet and exercise. First off, a low-fiber diet. You see, with a low-fiber diet, you don't have much motility in your intestines, and therefore, you are retaining carcinogens longer. So if a low-fiber diet is bad, well, what diet do you think is good? Right, a high-fiber diet is recommended. And you want a lot of fruits and vegetables and whole grains. Now, we're going to talk more about that in just a little bit. So, let's look at the rest of the dietary risk on your student pages. Increased red meat consumption and animal fat. Nitrites, like in processed sandwich meats, salt, cured or smoked meats. There's alcohol again. And then preservatives and additives. Now, you know, really the big push is to eat more natural foods, like whole grain foods, things like that with no preservatives or additives, and organically grown. That sort of thing really is the best. Now, next you have obesity. Obesity, or physical inactivity, and poor nutrition. Those really all go together, don't they? Okay. And these are major risk factors for the development of cancer. In fact, obesity alone contributes to 20% of all cancer deaths. Now, ready for two more risk factors that increase the incidence of cancer? Well, you are going to see that these also are related. There are increased incidence of cancer in the immunosuppressed. The immunosuppressed. But do you know what is the most important risk factor for cancer? I'll give you a hint. It's something that you, unfortunately, can't control. Yes, the most important risk factor for cancer is aging. Aging. That is why there is a higher incidence of cancer if you are greater than 60. Now, one reason is, the older you get, the poorer your immune system is, right? Right. So let me talk about the immune system. You know, right now, in your body, all of us have cancer cells. But we have a good immune system, so what is your immune system able to do? Recognize those cancer cells and destroy them. But y'all know, look, as you age, you cannot fight off cancer cells as easily because your immune system doesn't work as well. It's just a fact of life. The older you get, the greater the chance it is that you are going to get cancer. Now, you have had cells in your body a long time, and mutations or changes can occur. DNA can get messed up, and then what happens? The cancer comes out of hiding. Also, you have got to remember that the older you are, the longer you have been exposed to environmental toxins. So again, your risk for cancer, it increases. Now, what about cultural influences or hereditary factors? Should they be considered? Absolutely. And they are the next two listed in your student pages. Now, culturally, African Americans have the greatest incidence, of cancer, followed by Caucasians. And look, it's just a fact. And hereditary, like the BRCA1 gene, the BRCA gene for breast cancer, There are many advancements in gene studies and cancer risks. In fact, much of today's research is devoted to finding missing or defective genes that cause or increase an individual's risk for certain cancers. Now let's move on to our last category, and that is environmental risks. Exposure to ultraviolet radiation. So protect your skin from sunlight and tanning beds. Did you hear me say tanning beds? Yes, and you know I'm right. You are being radiated in that tanning bed, and that is what causes that nice glowing tan. Also, we have exposure to carcinogens like asbestos, soot, diesel, or diesel exhaust, and the list goes on and on. Now, the next thing on your handout is stress. You know stress is connected to everything now. Can an increase in stress over time weaken the immune system? Sure it can. Should we tell patients things like exercise regularly to decrease stress, yoga, meditation? Should we say things like that? Yes, whatever works to decrease their stress. Now, chronic irritation. Chronic irritation can cause uncontrolled growth of abnormal cells. Now look, what if I have a mole right here where my collar rubs me every day? That's irritation, isn't it? Does smoking irritate your lungs? Yes. So there are lots of things out there that can cause irritation. Look, what about chronic reflux or heartburn? Chronic reflux can lead to esophageal cancer because that is irritation. And lastly, previous history of other types of cancer or chemotherapy. Look, for example, a patient that received chemotherapy for one type of cancer, like breast cancer or colorectal cancer, is then at risk for developing other hematologic malignancies, like leukemia. Okay, now let's talk about what we can do to teach our clients about cancer prevention and screening. The first thing is primary prevention. This is a term used a lot when you are studying cancer, and these are ways to help prevent the actual occurrence of cancer. Now ask your friend, what types of things are considered primary prevention for cancer? And look, real quick, here's a hint. These are things that you have heard all your life, things that are good for you. All right, let's see if you came up with what is listed in your student pages. Primary prevention includes things like no smoking, we know that, exercise and good nutrition, maintain normal body weight, limit or eliminate alcohol intake, vaccines for preventable viral exposures like hepatitis B and HPV, avoiding exposure to known carcinogens, like wear sunscreen, well, we know that. Avoid prolonged sun exposure. Avoid secondhand smoke and, you know, those kinds of things. Okay, now do you have primary prevention straight? Then let's look at secondary prevention. This is when we use screenings to pick up on cancer early. Screenings are very important because we have a greater chance for cure or control if we can detect the cancer early. So let's divide this up and look at secondary prevention for the female. First of all, breast self-awareness is recommended as secondary prevention. Beginning in their 20s, women should be told about the benefits and limitations of the monthly breast self-exam. Now y'all, on what days of the menstrual cycle is it the best time to do the self-breast exam? Ask your friend. Day 7 through 12. Anytime from day 7 through 12. The key is this. Do the exam after the period is just about over with. You would never want to do the self-breast exam prior to the period because that is when they're going to have a lot of swelling and tenderness, and they are not going to get a very good exam that way. So it is always after the period is just about over. Anytime from day 7 through day 12. Now, if you have somebody who is postmenopausal or has had a hysterectomy, of course they are not having a period. So what you do is you teach them to remember just a certain day, like, well, what is your birthday? Okay, it's February 17th. Well, the 17th of every month, you need to remember to do a self-breast exam. Also, yearly clinical breast exams. Yearly clinical breast exams for women greater than 40 years of age. Women between the ages of 20 and 39 need one every 3 years. Now, when I say clinical breast exam, I mean in a physician's office setting, okay? Now, mammogram, annually, starting at age 40. Starting at age 40 with two views of each breast, okay? Now, before a mammogram, what should you tell your client not to have on their body? Ask your friend. No lotion, no powder, no deodorant. No deodorant. See, y'all, when you have lotion, powder, or deodorant on, that can be picked up on the mammogram as a calcium deposit. It looks like a calcium deposit, and most of the time, when we see a report for a client that has a calcium deposit, that usually means cancer. But here's the deal, though. Many women have not been told that prior to going to their mammogram, so the first thing they always do when they get there is they give them a washcloth and tell them to bathe off really, really well to make sure that they get off all the powder, deodorant, or whatever they have on off. Now, a pap smear is recommended beginning at age 21 and performed every 3 years if there have been no problems. Every 3 years, if there have been no problems. A colonoscopy at age 50. Age 50, then every 10 years after that, if there has been no problems. The more problems you have, the more frequent you have to have those sorts of things done. Now, testing the stool for fecal occult blood should also be done yearly. Done yearly, beginning at age 50. Unless previous problems or a positive family history. All right, now let's look at secondary prevention for the male. They also need to be provided with information on breast self-awareness and have yearly clinical testicular exams. Yearly clinical testicular exams. Testicular tumors grow very, very fast, so many clinicians recommend monthly testicular self-exams. Now, the major age group that gets testicular cancer are males between ages 15 and 36. So young males, the TSE needs to be taught early. Okay, the digital rectal exam and the PSA, the prostate-specific antigen, may be checked annually for men over the age of 50. A colonoscopy at age 50, and then every 10 years. Fecal occult blood testing should be done yearly. Done yearly. And don't forget, there's also tertiary prevention. Tertiary prevention focuses on the management of long-term care for clients with complex treatments for cancer. And some examples of these, of tertiary care, are support groups and rehabilitation programs. Now on to diagnosis. Well, how do we know someone has cancer? Well, to start with, we can look at general signs and symptoms. Now, look at the acronym CAUTION that's there on your page. Read those to yourself real quick. And you know what these are. They're warning signs and signs of what needs further investigation. If someone has any one of these things, then they need a further assessment. Now, we know that cancer can invade the bone marrow, which can lead to anemia, leukopenia, and thrombocytopenia. Anemia, leukopenia, and thrombocytopenia. So if you ever get an anemia question, you know you are really focusing on hypoxia, right? And if you have someone with leukopenia, they are at risk for infection. Now look, why are they at risk for infection? Ask your friend. Did you say leukopenia means low white blood cells and low white blood cells mean infection? Y'all, leukocytes are just the fancy name for white blood cells, so leukopenia is a low white count. Also, if you get a thrombocytopenia question, you have got somebody who's going to bleed. Now, We're going to talk about bleeding precautions later, but you know what those are. Like use an electric razor, use soft toothbrushes. If it is a child, then quiet play because you don't want them, you know, playing too rambunctiously and that sort of thing. Also, no IMs when you have bleeding precautions. All right, now let's get back to general cancer signs and symptoms. We also have unexplained weight loss. Unexplained weight loss. Look, whenever anyone reports weight loss and they actually haven't been trying to lose weight, y'all, that's a red flag. Cachexia is another term we have heard used when studying cancer, and that means extreme wasting and malnutrition. You may hear somebody described as being cachexic. That's usually seen close to death when the client is not able to eat anymore, and they've just lost lots and lots of weight. Okay, moving on. Fever is very common with cancer, especially if the cancer has spread. Now, which cancer do you see fever as a very early sign? That's right, you remembered. It's the leukemia and also the lymphomas. Okay, fatigue is another general sign, and it is the number one symptom, that clients complain of with a diagnosis of cancer. It may be caused by the anemia we talked about earlier, or the tumor is growing and taking all the patient's energy. Now, I'm not talking about just tired. I'm actually talking about exhaustion that doesn't get better with sleep. You know how tired you are after clinical? You're so tired after clinical that you can hardly even talk, right? Well, multiply that by 10, and that's the fatigue that I'm talking about here. Okay, the last general sign and symptom is pain. Pain is an early sign of bone cancers, testicular cancers, and even brain cancer. It may be a severe headache, like with brain cancer, or maybe back pain if the cancer is in the colon, ovaries, or rectum. Pain can mean a lot of different problems are going on, so never ever ignore a client's report of pain. Now, y'all. Blood tests are a biggie when it comes to diagnosis. So let's look at some common blood tests. The first one is an abnormal CBC and diff. Y'all remember that the diff or differential refers to the number of different types of white blood cells that are in the blood. The white blood cell differential cells in a complete blood count are the neutrophils, the lymphocytes, the basophils, the eosinophils, and the monocytes. But which one is the one we always worry about with cancer? The neutrophils. Thank goodness we don't have to remember all those other cells right now. Thank goodness. Okay? You are going to hear the word neutrophils a lot in this lecture. Now moving on. Elevated liver enzymes is the next one. These are your AST and your ALT. They tell you if the liver is being damaged, and we don't want the liver involved, so watch these numbers closely. And lastly, we have tumor markers. Tumor markers, also known as biomarkers. These are substances found at higher than normal levels in the blood, urine, or body tissue of some people with cancer. Now, you probably have heard of the breast cancer awareness people on TV talk about the CA15-3 biomarker. It's a tumor marker for breast cancer. And y'all know there are lots of blood tests that they could do. These are just some of the more common ones. All right, moving on. Let's look at diagnostic studies for cancer. We have a long list on your page of positive diagnostic studies, so let's read them together. Chest x-ray, a CT scan, an MRI, a PET scan, bone marrow biopsies, tissue biopsies, and imaging studies. Let's talk a few minutes and talk about the care of a client with a trach. Because look, could a cancer patient have a trach? Well, yes, sure they could. And you know the NCLEX lady just might ask you about it. So, let's talk about the trach for a second. First, look at your pretty little picture there on your handout. That's where they are going to put the trach. Okay, now look, let's do a critical thinking exercise about tracheostomy care. Y'all just listen, this is not on your handout. Let's pretend that you are working the night shift. It's 3 a.m. and for some reason, this is when you decide that you are going to do trach care on your client with laryngeal cancer. Now, you know that your teacher told you when you are changing out the string that you are not supposed to ever move your hand from here, right? You've got to hold this in place, right? Okay, but you forgot. And your client coughs and the trach flies across the room like a missile and lands on the other side of the bed. Tell your friend how you would handle this critical thinking exercise. Go. All right, well look, wouldn't it be great if there were a sterile trach set sitting at the bedside waiting for you to reinsert? Wouldn't that be wonderful? But y'all, the answer that you want is never, ever going to be there now, is it? So, what else could you do? Sterile Vaseline gauze, taped down three sides? What do you think? I don't think we're going to cover up the airway. Put your finger in it? No. What are you going to do? Look, a sterile trach is not there. What else does that leave you to do? See, we have got to look for options on this test because NCLEX already knows the perfect answer is in your brain. And you know that the perfect answer is to get what? A sterile trach, but the perfect answer is never going to be there. Well, what else can you do if you know it's going to collapse if you wait much longer? You better run to the other side of the bed, blow it off, and do what? Reinsert it. Now, you don't really have to blow it off, but you better reinsert it. You do whatever you have to do to reestablish the airway. Now, write this down. Reinsert the dirty trach. And I know that is going to tear you up because I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, well, Stuart, it's been on the floor. That's gross. You know, they'll kick me out of nursing school for that, right? Hey, let me ask you this. Would you rather be alive with an infection or dead without one? Now, you tell me, which would you rather have? You know, look at her. You know, she's dead, graveyard dead, but she's infection-free, right? No, that's not nice. You keep them alive and you reestablish their airway. Look, we can give antibiotics later. All right. Now, when you have situations where you need an emergency tracheotomy, okay, like with the burn people we were talking about earlier, that is when you use a trach tube versus a laryngectomy tube. A trach has a slightly different shape than the laryngectomy tube. People go home with a trach, but they are called laryngectomy tubes then. A laryngectomy tube is smaller around. It is the same thing as a trach, but it has a different name. It's long term, okay? You use it forever. It's smaller around and it's not as long as a trach tube. So let's just quickly review a laryngectomy. Now, a total laryngectomy. Now, let me emphasize something. Look, in the hospital, there are lots of different types of laryngectomies. You have partial, you have subglottic, and in your med-surg books, you know, they will go into detail about all the different types of laryngectomies. I am focusing on a total laryngectomy. Okay, now, patients that have head and neck cancers might end up with a total laryngectomy. That is removal of the vocal cords, the epiglottis, and the thyroid cartilage. The vocal cords, the epiglottis, and the thyroid cartilage. The whole larynx, not just part of it. Now, I want you to point to your thyroid cartilage right now. Point to it. Does everybody know where it is? Look at you. Don't even know where it is, okay? It's up here, all right? It's these two flat pieces of cartilage up here. You don't need them. Let them go, okay? Now, out of these three things that I have listed there, which ones are you most concerned about losing? Which ones? Now, I heard vocal cords because I know you're scared you're not going to be able to talk anymore. Well, look, you better be worried about losing the epiglottis, okay? Because that is what covers your airway when you swallow. So you won't aspirate. Now, since the whole larynx, remember, this includes the epiglottis, is removed, this client is going to have a permanent tracheostomy or laryngectomy, okay? A permanent tracheostomy or laryngectomy, whatever you want to call it, okay? They will actually be breathing out of the stoma, not their mouth or their nose, for the rest of their life. Now think about it, y'all. If they have removed your epiglottis, that means that now you have two tubes up into your oropharynx, your trachea and your esophagus. So every time the client swallows, they don't have an epiglottis. So there's two tubes for food and fluid to go down. So they are going to aspirate every single time. Okay? That is why they can't leave the trach in the oropharynx anymore. They have to reroute it out through your neck, right? So all of your breathing is actually done right here. Okay? There is not another tube going up into your oropharynx anymore. So all of your breathing is done through the trach. Okay? So any respiratory secretions are also going to be in the trach. Patients will have to cough them up, or you may have to suction them frequently, especially, you know, with a fresh trach. And of course, like we said earlier, we could get our sputum specimen through the trach as well. Okay, now let's move on to position, post-op position. What position would you put the laryngectomy client in post-op? Remember, we had surgery, y'all, up here, okay? Now look, I heard Fowlers. High Fowlers, mid Fowlers, low Fowlers. Well, which Fowlers is it? Y'all, that's a lot of Fowlers. Well, I always say this. Look, pick the one that is sitting up the most, but don't pick high Fowlers. Y'all, look, you know you have never seen anyone riding back from surgery sitting straight up in the bed, riding down the hall like that, now have you? No, okay? So mid-Fowlers is fine. Head of bed at 35 to 45 degrees is fine. Mid-Fowlers, 35 to 45 degrees, remember that. Now, do you agree that with any surgery that there is always a little bit of edema? Yeah. But we don't want any edema up here, okay? Because it's just too close to my airway, okay? Next, we have NG feedings. NG feedings to protect the suture line. Why? Well, because peristalsis can disrupt the suture line. Disrupt the suture line. Some books may say NG feedings because it hurts to swallow. And I'm sure it does hurt to swallow. But what is more important, the pain or protecting the suture line? Of course, it's protecting the suture line. Okay, y'all, we also will be monitoring the drains, if they have any, which would just prevent any fluid from accumulating up here, okay? And also, watch for carotid artery rupture, which just sounds like a bad thing, right? Right. Now, do you agree that because of the proximity of your carotids to the surgical site, that there is a chance that one of them could have become nicked during the surgery? Yes, so the client naturally could hemorrhage. Now, another thing that we have is called rupture of the innominate artery. And y'all know when this happens because the person begins to bleed massively from the trach, okay? Is it an emergency? Yes, you'll be scared to death and you can't fix it. They need to go to the operating room ASAP. You see, if there is nothing that you can do to help the person, that's when you call a physician. Okay, now let me ask you a question. What if it said on the test that you've got a hemorrhaging trach? Which action takes priority? Call the primary health care provider or check the vital signs? What would you pick? Tell your friend. Well, look, you had better call the physician, because you've only got one chance to tell the NCLEX people the most important thing you would do. But didn't check the vital signs sound good? Yes, because in school, what did they tell you? Well, you better check the vital signs before you call the primary health care provider, or they're going to get really, really mad, right? Well, look, NCLEX people don't care if the physician gets mad. NCLEX is saying, hey, new nurse, if you could only do one thing, what is the one thing you would do here? Well, you better tell them that if you don't do anything else, I promise I'm going to call the primary care provider. Because if you pick check the vital signs, you're telling the NCLEX people, okay, for a pulsating trach, that's the one thing I'm going to do. I'm going to check the vital signs over and over and over again. while my client dies. That's why this answer doesn't work here, okay? If you use this strategy, it will help you get rid of answers like check the vital signs and that sort of thing. When it says priority, you've got one shot at telling them the most important thing to do. And when you realize that NCLEX is about life and death situations, you'll pick the better of the two answers every time. Okay, now back to caring for a laryngectomy patient. First, provide frequent mouth care. Frequent mouth care to decrease the bacterial count in the mouth. Okay, NPO people tend to get pneumonia. Y'all, if they have a lot of bacteria that's up in their mouth, that bacteria is going to travel down to their new trach site, or it could travel all the way down to their lungs and cause pneumonia. Now, when the person leaves the hospital, a bib will be used to cover the trach because it acts like a filter for one thing. Also, there are a lot of body image changes when people have a trach. Okay? They feel more comfortable with something that they can use to cover the site. All right? Now, when you are selecting something to go over the trach, don't you think it will be important that air is able to move through it? Well, yes, okay? But sometimes you'll read in textbooks where it will say that plastic can be used. Now look, if you selected plastic on the NCLEX to be placed over the trach, are you going to get a license? No, because you cannot breathe through plastic, okay? You don't pick things that have a lot of fibers in them either, okay? Because that will irritate the trach, like a washcloth and that sort of thing. Also, keep powder from the trach too. That's going to irritate it. Now, a humidified environment helps, okay? And you know, when you and I breathe in, we breathe in through our mouth and nose, so we are warming, filtering, and humidifying the air that we breathe, okay? Well, when you're breathing in through here, okay, you don't have a way to warm, filter, and humidify. So the air going in is really, really dry. So it irritates the trach, and that's why when you first get a trach, it has a lot of secretions, okay? And you need to be an advocate for your client and tell them as time goes on, the secretions will decrease and that a humidified environment will help with that. And look, y'all know that advocating for and teaching our clients, that's very important. And the NCLEX likes those kind of answers. Now also, remember with a total laryngectomy, all breathing is done through the stoma. So how does a client with a total laryngectomy talk? Well, they can use an electrolarynx, but the Blomsinger device is the most common device they use to talk. Okay, so can the client with a total laryngectomy whistle? Well, what do you have to be able to do to whistle? Pull air in, right? Well, they can't do that, okay? Now look, can you drink through a straw with a total laryngectomy? If you don't have a trach going up into here, can you drink through a straw? No, because you have to be able to form a suction, right? So it will be mean to go up to your little client and say, now come on, drink your apple juice, wouldn't it? You know, pull on the straw, Paw. No, they can't. That's very, very mean. Don't do that. Now, could I smoke? If I'm breathing in and out through the neck, can I smoke? It's not recommended, is it? Now, don't get me wrong. You will see people at casinos. I'm sure you see them at casinos smoking through their trach, right? Y'all, it's not recommended, but, you know, they can still do it if they want to. Now, what if I have a total laryngectomy and I have been a world champion swimmer forever and ever, and now I've got a trach? Can I still go swimming? Say I've had my trach for like 4 or 5 years. I'm really, really used to it. Can I go swimming? Not recommended, right? No, look, think about it. I'm breathing in and out through my neck. When I go over here to the deep end and I jump into the deep end, what am I going to do? Drown? You're not going to get a license that way now, are you? No. Okay, but look, let me make you feel a little bit better. I have had people that went on to pass boards that said, yes, they can go swimming if they plug up their trach. Now, y'all, are you going to get a license in the mail if you go around plugging up people's trachs or putting stuff in people's trachs? No, you don't. Okay, so don't do that. Enough on procedures. Okay, now moving on. Let's talk about treatment for cancer. Treatment for cancer. Y'all, when it comes to treatment, what do you think the goals are for cancer patients? Well, cure the cancer, of course, but what if that's not possible? We have three general goals of treatment. Here we go. A is cure, B is control, and C is palliation. Okay? Cure, control, and palliation. See, cure is first. Now, we always want to cure cancer, but sometimes the best we can do is control the spread of the disease or provide palliative care. Now, what do I mean when I say palliative or, you know, palliation? What does that mean? Did I hear comfortable? Yes, keep them comfortable, whatever it takes to relieve symptoms. Now, y'all know there are lots of different cancer treatments out there, but for NCLEX, we are just going to focus on surgery, radiation, chemo, and a few others that are commonly used. But before we even talk about cancer treatments, there are two terms you need to understand, and they are adjuvant and neoadjuvant. Adjuvant is when two therapies are used together. Two therapies are used together, like chemo and radiation. Neoadjuvant are time-specific therapies, or one before the next. This would be like surgery and then chemo, okay? You are going to see these terms a lot when talking about cancer treatments. Now, because the treatment plan is going to be specific for the client, the physician will base the treatment plan on the recommended treatment plans for the diagnosis, the grade of cancer, and even what the client does or does not want. And y'all, this is definitely a goal of treatment to have the client involved. Very important to keep the client involved. Now, types of cancer treatments. The first one we think of is surgery. If I have cancer, I want them to remove everything they can and get it all, right? But really, surgery has many roles when it comes to cancer treatment. Surgery may be used for prevention, like removing a precancerous or benign lesion. Diagnosis. Some cancers like ovarian and colorectal cancers are not staged until surgery. Also, tumor biopsy and lymph node mapping may be done during surgery as part of a diagnosis. Surgery can also be used for treatment, like removing all or part of the tumor, or even reconstruction. Breast cancer is one of the most common cancers where they do reconstruction. So let's talk about it just for a minute here. When a patient is looking at surgical treatment for breast cancer, they have many more options than they did in the past. Options can include a lumpectomy, a unilateral or bilateral mastectomy. The mastectomy may be either partial or total, also called radical. And patients may elect to have reconstruction with any of these procedures. And depending on the patient, reconstruction can be done with the initial surgery or a later surgery. Now, post-op care following a mastectomy. We're going to check for bleeding by checking the dressings, okay? Especially on the back. Now, why are we checking the back, y'all? If the surgery is in the front, then why are we checking the back? Because pulling can occur. And remember, when you have pulling of blood, it doesn't always come out on the sheets where you can see it. You may have pulling of blood in the tissue, okay, back here. Now, if they had reconstruction using their own tissue, they will also have an abdominal surgical site. They can harvest adipose tissue from other sites for reconstruction, but the abdomen is the most common. Also, we're going to check their HemoVac or Jackson-Pratt drains. Many times, patients will come back with an ACE compression bandage or binder. It just depends on the physician. Now, associated nursing care. If any lymph nodes were removed with the mastectomy, and this would be for a mastectomy with or without reconstruction, the important point here is that lymph nodes have been removed. So, stay away from the arm on the affected side for the lifetime of the client. They need to be taught that you protect that arm forever. For instance, no constriction, so no blood pressures. And y'all know these, no blood pressures. Also, when I think of constriction, I think of blouses with elastic or wearing a watch. They don't even want you carrying a purse anymore because that is a type of constriction. No blood pressures, no injections. Wear gloves when gardening. Watch small cuts. No nail biting. No sunburn. No IV. I mean, no nothing. See, if you don't have your lymphatic system, you know, over here anymore, okay, do you have the ability to fight infection like you used to? No. So one little nick could turn into a major wound infection. Other things to remember post-mastectomy. Brush hair, squeeze tennis balls, wall climbing, flex and extend the elbow. Why? This promotes new circulation. New circulation. Sometimes called collateral circulation. Again, collateral circulation. And that's a good thing after a mastectomy. Okay, now look, let's do a critical thinking exercise. I just had a mastectomy with reconstruction, and day one post-op, you come into my room and say, okay, Stuart, I need for you to brush your hair, okay? So you give me a hairbrush. First of all, I'm going to try to take the brush with the opposite arm because it doesn't hurt over here, all right? This is my good side. It doesn't hurt over here, okay? But you say, no, I really mean on the affected side or the surgical side. So I take the hairbrush, okay? How am I going to brush my hair day one post-op? Like this, right? Okay? Barely even using my arm. Why? Well, because it hurts, okay? You're protecting this arm, okay? That's why you get things like frozen shoulder. But that is why we have them doing these other things too, like the wall climbing exercises. Because every day, you want them to go up the wall a little further. Now, let me ask you, do you think surgery can be used for palliative care? Well, can it make the patient more comfortable or relieve symptoms? Yes. So, when is surgery palliative care? Well, when surgery would improve the client's quality of life, like debulking with pancreatic cancer. Because even though the pancreatic cancer can't be cured, by reducing the size of the tumor, you are going to improve their quality of life. That's great. When you're talking about surgery for cancer, successful surgery is dependent on three things. Okay? Could the cancer be completely removed? Had the cancer already spread at the time of the surgery, like the lymph nodes? And was the surgeon able to get adequate margins? Adequate margins. So, what do we mean by adequate margins? Adequate margins is the amount of normal tissue around the tumor that is also removed. It's the amount that is considered adequate, okay? You say they look at the type and the size of the cancer, and there are guidelines or standards that tell them how many millimeters or centimeters to remove around the tumor. If the margins are clear, is there still a chance that the cancer could have metastasized? Yes, because the risk of micrometastasis. Now, it's pretty clear what micrometastasis means, but what impact does it have on the treatment? You remember the words neoadjuvant therapy? Yes, if the surgeon ever suspects that there may be just a little micrometastasis, then therapy will be surgery with chemo or radiation. Sometimes the surgeon will be so concerned about the risk of micrometastasis that radiation and/or chemo may be done even before surgery. All right, Let's talk about radiation therapy as a treatment for cancer. Now look, we've got two different types of radiation. We've got internal and we've got external. Now, radiation delivers a high dose of radiation to a localized area. So at first, let's talk about, number one, internal radiation. Now, another name for that is brachytherapy. Brachytherapy. They use brachytherapy to get the radiation close to the cancer or target tissue. Again, close to the cancer or target tissue. It is internal radiation, so it is inside the body. Again, inside the body. Brachytherapy is close to the target tissue because the radiation is inside the body. Now, with all types of brachytherapy, the client emits radiation for a period of time and is hazardous to others. Now, you must know if the brachytherapy being used is unsealed or sealed. You see, unsealed radiation causes the client to emit radiation through their body fluids. This is like a radioisotope that is given IV or PO. IV or PO. Now, when I think of this type, the thing I always think of is somebody that is treated for hyperthyroidism, and they give them the radioactive isotope. But it is also used for thyroid cancer. They are radioactive for about 24 to 48 hours, and then they're okay. Now, sealed or solid radiation therapy is when the client is actually emitting the radiation. Sealed radiation can be temporary or a permanent implant. Again, a permanent implant that is placed close to or inside the tumor. Now, y'all, they are placing the radiation directly into the cancerous area. They can place what they call seeds into the diseased area, or you may see special catheters for the direct injection into the cancer. It's that sort of thing where it goes directly into the involved area. So let's do a critical thinking exercise. Pawpaw has cancer of the prostate and has seeds implanted into the prostate area. Would a good diversional activity be for him to read to his grandchildren? Well, not if he's holding them in his lap, right? Is he emitting radiation? Yes. Do you even want his grandchildren close to him right now? No. All right. So let's say that you get into the test and you just can't remember all these different details and remember which ones emit radiation and which ones do not. Okay. If you were just thinking general, as a brand new nurse, what would be the safest thing for you to say here? Well, just pretend that they all do. That is, if you can't remember all the details to what I'm saying. Like I said, you know, some do emit radiation and some do not. But y'all, they don't expect us to be oncology experts, okay? So if you get in a bind on the NCLEX question, just pretend that they all emit radiation and you will be safe that way. Because thinking like that, you won't hurt somebody, okay? All right. Now, treatment of cervical cancer is another good example of when a radiation implant might be used. Treatment of a cervical cancer. The implant is inserted into the vagina and has contact with the cervix. There are high-dose radiation treatments and low-dose radiation treatments, and the implants can stay in place for hours to a couple of days. So, let's review the general radiation precautions you would need to take with internal radiation. Remember these three words: time, distance, and shielding. How much time do I want to spend with this patient? Only short visits. Now, how far do I need to stand from the patient? As far as possible to get the task done, and wear a lead shield if you have to break these rules. So, nursing assignments should be rotated daily, so that the nurse is not continuously exposed. And the nurse should only care for one client with a radiation implant in a given shift. You know, you're not supposed to say, okay, well, let Sue take care of three radioactive implant clients today. Okay, no, that's not nice. Don't do that. A private room is needed. A private room is needed. And wear a film badge at all times. You need to wear your little badge that tells you how much radiation you're getting and keep up with it. And don't give your badge to someone else and say, okay, well, now you wear it for a little while. You're not going to know exactly how much radiation someone has been given if you do that. So keep up with your own badge. Now, restrict visitors. Restrict visitors. Limit each visitor to 30 minutes per day. And the visitor must stay at least 6 feet from the source. 6 feet from the source. Now look, as nurses, sometimes we have got to get close, right? But this is why your teacher told you when you were studying radiation, especially internal radiation like this, they told you to get your act together before you went into the room, right? So you go into the room and you get what you have to get done over with and you hurry up and get out. Now, that's also why these people can get so depressed, okay, because they are by themselves all the time. So, look, we really have to consider that when we're taking care of these people. Also, no visitors less than 16 years of age. No pregnant visitors. We know that. No pregnant visitors. And be sure and mark the room with the instructions for the specific isotope telling you what to do. Also, you know this, wear gloves in case there is possible exposure to body fluids like urine and feces. Now look, another important thing to keep in mind is dislodgement. Now, how can you help prevent dislodgement of the implant? Well, you keep the client on bed rest, right? Keep them on bed rest. You decrease the fiber. Again, decrease the fiber in the diet. Now, the reason for that is this. If you have somebody who is eating a lot of fiber, that is going to distend the bowel. And when you distend the bowel, you could push out the implants. All right? So they need to be on a low-fiber diet. That's right, a low-fiber diet. Also, we want to prevent bladder distension. Prevent bladder distension. That's why, you know, they will just put about everybody on an indwelling catheter to prevent bladder distension. So, what do you do if the implant becomes dislodged? And there it is. You can see it. It's glowing in the bed. Tell your friend, what would you do? Well, look, if you can't remember what to do, put on gloves first, right? Yes, put on gloves. Always put on your gloves first, and you pick it up with forceps or tongs and place it in a what? A lead-lined container. That's right, a lead-lined container, okay? You do not take it out of the room. You call the radiation people, and you let them come get it. You see, look, the NCLEX people, they want to make sure that you don't find something glowing in the bed and you stick it in your pocket, right? No, they don't want you to do that, okay? Part of the NCLEX is not just about protecting the client. It is also about, look, do you have enough sense to protect yourself and the other people that you work with too? All right. Now, don't forget this client is immunosuppressed as well. So anytime you are thinking about someone who is immunosuppressed, do you have to consider the type of client that will go into the room with them? Yes, but look, with this client, they are in a private room, okay? But if on the NCLEX, they put you in a bind and you had to select somebody, just remember that you would never put somebody that had an infection in the room with somebody that is immunosuppressed. Look, that's just a general rule, and you know that. But this person is going to be in a private room because they are radiating to the general environment. Now, y'all, when a patient receiving radiation goes home, should they sleep in the same bed with their spouse or children? What do you think? I hope you said no, okay? They should sleep in a separate bed with at least 6 feet of separation from others for 1 to 11 days, depending on the type of radiation. Now, should they use public transportation? No. Look, in fact, they should stay 6 feet away from others and not around children at all for 2 to 3 days. Can they return to work immediately? Well, no, we know that. Okay, what about sharing eating utensils or even cooking for others? Again, the trend is no, not for several days. Now, will one flush of the toilet be enough to dispose of the excrements? No, they need to close the lid and flush it 2 to 3 times because that is how they are losing the radiation. Okay, the next thing is external radiation, which is also called teletherapy, or another name is external beam radiotherapy. You may have seen a picture of this in your textbooks. The patient sits or lies on an x-ray table, and a carefully focused beam of high energy rays is delivered by a machine outside of the body. In contrast to internal radiotherapy, brachytherapy, in which the radiation source is inside the body, external beam radiotherapy directs the radiation at the tumor from outside the body. Now, I bet you have heard of cobalt machines or gamma knife machines. These are examples of machines that emit external radiation. The radiation therapy team uses computer software to control the size of the beam so it can accurately bombard the tumor. And this process is very precise, as you can imagine. If the beam is not directed properly, what could I damage? That's right, normal tissue, exactly. That is what we are afraid of. We do not want to damage nearby organs or normal tissue, right? Right. Now, do you think that this patient is radioactive? No, the client is not radioactive. Not radioactive. In fact, side effects are usually limited to exposed tissues. This patient is going to be radiated in the same spot for many days, and that one little spot is going to get really, really dry, and the skin may start breaking down. So you need to closely monitor the exposed tissue for side effects. Other symptoms in general with teletherapy are, erythema, because the skin is irritated and inflamed. Also, shedding of the skin. Skin problems are what I think of first with teletherapy. Also, altered taste. Fatigue is a biggie. Fatigue is the number one complaint or side effect of radiation therapy. So put a big old star by that one, fatigue. Also, pancytopenia. Pancytopenia is when all of the blood components are decreased. Your red blood cells, your platelets, and your white blood cells, everything, y'all. Pan means everything. Also, your handout says many signs and symptoms are location and dose related. Again, location and dose related. For instance, if I have a brain tumor and they are radiating me here, that's when I'm going to lose my hair, have impaired taste, and have sores in my mouth. It is very local to where they are radiating you. Now, is it okay to wash off the markings? What do you think? No, it's not. Is it okay to use lotion on the markings? Again, no. They don't want you to put anything on the markings unless it has been ordered by the physician. And y'all know that. They don't want you to put anything on those markings. They have been put there for a very important reason. And also, y'all, protect the site from sunlight and UV exposure for 1 year after completion of therapy. Well, it makes sense that you want to protect it while the area is so inflamed, right? But they have to continue protecting the site for several months later because the skin is still very, very fragile. Good skin care. No lotions, powder, or ointments without a physician's order. All right, now I know you all are tired. Let's take a 10-minute break. Come back fresh for the second half.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to help support the podcast, please share it with others and leave a rating. We wish you all the best in the coming examination. See you next time.